first time in how many years?
Well, I've been in the industry for 20 years now. So, yeah, it's been a long time coming.
Hi, I'm John Yeager, and this is Bloodworks 101, the podcast brought to you by your friends here at Bloodworks Northwest, designed to inspire you to donate either time, money, or blood. The voice you heard at the top belongs to James Bancroft, a senior systems administrator for the BECS application here at Bloodworks Northwest. James will unpack what that means in a bit. He's from Great Britain, and he was scheduled to donate blood at our Renton Donor Center, which is why I spoke to him a little while back. Now, up until recently, those from Great Britain and other European countries were not eligible to donate. He was what we called a deferred donor because he lived in England between 1980 and 1996, and therefore may have been potentially exposed to mad cow disease. A little later in the episode, we'll talk to Co-Chief Medical Officer Dr. Kirsten Alcorn about this deferral, why it was put in place, and why it was removed. It's a change that could have a big impact on the blood supply. But first, I asked James Bancroft about his job.
So my role at Bloodworks is Senior Systems Administrator for the BECS application. BECS stands for Blood Establishment Computer System, which is the back-end computer system that controls everything that we do.
So. And so ironically, last night?
Yeah, last night I was one of three of us who were putting all of the changes into effect that would affect the blood donations today. So removing the deferrals if you answer yes to certain questions. So yeah, very exciting.
So you get to see it, and you're affected by it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's fantastic, and it's been a long time coming. Yeah. But it's, there's a lot of donors that are impacted by this. I mean, just in our database of donors, there's thousands of donors who have attempted to donate who had this deferral on their file, which are now eligible again.
And you see them when they get the questionnaire and they look at it and they read in deeply. It's like 1980 to 96 in these countries. And it's like, wait a minute. Oh, and they have to do the math. And then all of a sudden, no, they can't.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so there was that. And there was France, Ireland. And then prior to now, we had the military deferral as well. That got removed a couple of years ago now. But this one is the last one to get pulled off.
And when you think about it, we're in code red so many times. Mm-hmm. We're right at the edge so many times. And then we're going to reach out to another 10,000 potential donors. That could make a difference.
That's a huge difference. I mean, 10,000 donors, that's potentially 30,000 more blood products available to our hospitals, to patients that need it. It's huge. And the funny thing is that like over the last 20 years, I never actually thought that I would see this deferral get lifted in my lifetime. I knew that they were working on ways to be able to test it, but I never actually thought they'd lift the deferral. And so it's just really cool to be able to see that happen.
You're not afraid of needles, are you?
Not in the slightest. I've been in so many donor centers over the years and watched so much of this. It's kind of exciting, actually.
Then I watched the blood collection specialist ask his series of questions as for the first time in more than 20 years, James Bancroft was finally able to donate blood.
This is your first time donating, so yes. Take one precaution. I'm just going to tilt you back a little bit.
Totally fine.
And please let us know if you do start feeling anything out of the ordinary.
I certainly will.
Wait, is this the arm you want to use?
Likely, yes.
All right, so let's see if you have a good thing if you're right. Squeeze. Oh, yeah. Just hold that fist for me, tight fist. And you can go ahead and release. Do you go by Jim?
No, James.
James? Okay. Just going to clean your arm for 30 seconds.
Oh, those alarms. I spent so many years waking up to the sound of that in my sleep. I worked for that company for almost 15 years.
Really? Yeah. You told me for that.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to do the same thing. Squeeze, 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 and hold a tight fist for me. Just going to be a slight sting.
Yeah, no problem.
Go ahead and release. Doing okay?
Yes, sir.
Now that the donation was underway, Bancroft, the guy who couldn't donate for more than 20 years, told me why the needle really didn't hurt.
So there's multiple reasons, but the biggest reason I think that you know people have a sort of a perception about is that the needle looks really big and fat, right? And it looks like that's going to hurt poking through my skin. But it's not that it pokes through the skin. It actually cuts through the skin because the tip of the needle is like a surgical blade. So it's a double beveled edge that will just literally slides through the skin. So it really doesn't hurt as much as you think it's going to.
Surgical instrument, you know, yeah. we don't stop going for surgery because it's a surgical instrument.
No, exactly. So yeah, it doesn't, I mean, again, this is my first donation and I thought that there was going to be a little bit more pain than what I actually think. So I got blood taken a couple of days ago for blood test at my doctor's office. I actually think that hurt more than this.
Well, the checking on the iron level when they prick your finger hurts more than this.
Some people say that, yeah. And that's what I've heard, again, from being in this industry for so long, is that the finger stick in itself is probably one of the biggest single complaints from all dentists. And so I know there are moves in the industry to move away from doing that and to find some kind of non-invasive way of doing all of the iron checks and what have you. And there are devices out there that do it. It's just as we move along year over year, it gets better. The experience gets easier.
Now we're going to hear from our co-chief medical officer here at Bloodworks, Dr. Kirsten Alcorn, who can tell us why blood centers across the country started deferring English donors like James Bancroft years ago, and why we lifted the ban this year, and specifically about the questions now we're asking donors in the screening process when they come in to donate.
How does the question read right now, Kirsten?
The question actually reads the same as it did before. It's what's different is the way we respond to the answer. The question is, from 1980 through 1996, did you spend time that adds up to 3 months or more in the United Kingdom countries of, and then there's a list of countries that count as the United Kingdom. And if you were to say yes in the past, that would lead to some follow-up questions that could potentially lead to deferral based on the risk that we assigned to variant CJD. And if you said no, you would just move on to the next question. So now it moves on to a different type of follow-up question. So another question we had was, from 1980 through 2001, did you spend time that adds up to 5 years or more in France or Ireland? And that time spent in Ireland does not include time spent in Northern Ireland, which is considered part of the UK. So that question also is changing. If you say yes, it goes to a new response. And then the third question was, from 1980 to the present, did you receive a blood transfusion in France, Ireland, England, Northern Ireland, or all the other countries of the UK? And the response to that is changing.
So let's talk about why. Why was this asked in the first place, and what did it respond to?
Well, classical CJD, or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, is a very rare disease. It occurs consistently around the world, about one person in a million people. And about 85% of those cases fall into that so-called sporadic category. Then there's a small group that makes up 5 to 15% of the cases that come from a so-called familial CJD, and that's where a family has a common genetic profile that makes them process the proteins involved in CJD differently. So they have a higher risk for getting the disease. And then there are a couple of other much rarer syndromes where this can occur. So it's a very rare disease. And so far, we don't have strong evidence that it's found in blood or lymphoid tissue or that it can be spread that way, but we also know that it can be spread through exposure to neurologic tissue that's infected. And so this other group of cases is so-called iatrogenic cases, where it is spread through surgical techniques or the use of human growth hormone that was derived from other humans who were infected with CJD. Those cases are exceptionally rare, and the growth hormone thing, for example, the cohort of people who saw those infections were last treated with that, according to the FDA guidance document of 2022, they were last treated in 1977. So we're talking about a much older group of people and a treatment that no longer really exists. And then dura mater grafts are also pretty rare and coming from an infected person and so on. So CJD seems to have a low risk, but a theoretical risk of transmission through blood transfusion. So we want to have some level of safety around that.
Did this have anything to do with mad cow disease? Because that's always been my understanding. Maybe it's too simplistic, but put those things together for me.
So mad cow disease is variant CJD, which falls into that prion disease category. It looks a lot like CJD, except it has a different clinical presentation. And so it presents in younger people sooner after the potential exposure, has different symptoms and a different timeline of the course of illness. So it's different clinically, but it's related to the same kind of infectious agent. And that agent was recognized in the UK in the 80s. And then they had some number of people who had been blood donors who were later diagnosed with this disease. And they have followed the course of where all those donations went. And it looks like they may have as many as 4 people who look like they may have gotten variant CJD through a blood transfusion. Also, on the literature on VCJD, it looks like it has, in some cases, can be found in lymphoid tissue. Not necessarily in the blood, but in lymphoid tissue. And that's very closely associated with all of our blood cells and so on. So not knowing a whole lot more about all the dynamics of that relationship, we put into place a protective mechanism for the blood supply in the U.S. There have not been any cases of VCJD or CJD, classical type, due to blood transfusion in the U.S. We have had some patients in the U.S. who were diagnosed with VCJD who had received blood transfusions or other exposures while in the U.K.
Why is it being changed now?
It's being changed now because we put in this deferral when all of this data was coming out to show that there could be transfusion transmission. And now that we've gone this many years, we haven't seen it in the U.S. It's dropped off in the U.K. It's become a non-issue. So we think that the risk has gone down even lower than it maybe ever was. And so now we can change our donor criteria.
Well, and I'm always telling people that only 40% of us can donate blood, and of that 40%, only 10% actually do. And I suspect that we don't need to give people another reason why not to donate.
Well, of course that's true, and I think 10% of eligible donors actually donating is actually a pretty high estimate. I think a lot of people would estimate that that number is lower. When this went into effect, it was estimated that it would decrease the eligibility of donors in the U.S. by about 1%. And I think that that's true, especially in areas that are very cosmopolitan, such as cities like Seattle or Portland, where you have a lot of international travel, you have an international airport, you have large cosmopolitan city centers where people are coming and going. Maybe less so where you don't have an international airport, for example. But certainly I think cities like this have seen about a 1% drop off. And if we can regain 1% of the donor base, that would be wonderful. And those people are otherwise healthy, right? They haven't donated just because of this.
So that's really what it boils down to, isn't it? When you say it's 1%, I think, well, we're always telling people, I'm ringing the bell all the time with media, and I'm saying, it's code red. It's a perfect storm where the weather hit. All these little things that push us into an emergency situation. So maybe 1% could really help. It might make the difference sometimes.
Well, 1% of 100,000 is a real number, right? And the thing about having more people in the donor pool is that it means they can contribute. And if they do that on a regular basis, it's a multiplier. by however many times a year they can donate. But it also means those people are getting the opportunity, and they're also probably talking to their friends and family about it. And that's a really strong motivator for people who have never been donors. So if they see that their friend or family member is able to donate blood now, and they hear about that, maybe they'll also make an appointment and come along, or make an appointment for the next time, or something like that. They'll be inspired to make that donation. And so the more we can do that, the better and healthier that donor supply is. It takes a lot of awareness. You know, not everybody in the general public is gonna think, oh, I got deferred for that. But we're hoping to spread this information and bring that to people's attention, and they can think, I'm still healthy and well and capable of donating, and this was the only reason I couldn't donate, so why shouldn't I go back? Maybe I can try again. And even if they have traveled since then or continued their cosmopolitan lifestyle, they still have a chance, and that's wonderful.
So what's the story all about to you?
I think it's about the FDA using science to update the criteria, and that's what we're always asking them to do. And so here we are. We've made a step. All we can say really about that is thank you. This is an improvement, or it's in sync with science, and it results in a broader potential donor base. And so that's a great move forward. And I think the FDA is taking those requests to heart and trying to move a little bit more quickly through massive amounts of data on each one of these donor-related criteria so that we can be stepping up with the times and keeping up with the data as it comes out.
Well, I mean, it wasn't done for any capricious reason. It was based on science and the idea that even if it was one in a million, or if it was four cases, you don't want to expose the blood supply to some kind of toxicity or something that was dangerous. So there was a reason for it in the first place.
Absolutely. The FDA always has that kind of safety in mind. The question is sometimes, how long do they take to review the data? How much data do they need to review? How much data is prudent to review? What data is actually available? So something like this, four cases over what is now more than a 20-year period, amongst millions and millions and millions of blood donations in the UK, that's an incredibly low risk, even at the peak. So, and it also means that there's not going to be a lot of data to evaluate, because there's just not more cases. And so at some point you have to say, at what point have we achieved the data that we're going to get? And then how do we make a decision based on that? And the FDA is processing that for us. And so it is nice to see them making moves like this. There are other kinds of concerns along these lines with the FDA and medical-based criteria. And we're certainly in a discussion phase around group-associated deferral criteria versus individual risk-assessed deferral criteria for a number of questions on the DHQ. And so we're just continuing to modernize. And I think this is a nice step forward. It stems from some things that the FDA did early in the COVID pandemic, where they wanted to make prudent steps to loosen up the criteria for blood donors because the donor supply really shut down a lot in the pandemic.
So you're telling me that COVID-19 had something to do with this change in policy?
Absolutely. COVID-19 brought an immediate drop-off in blood donations all across the country. And the FDA responded with looking at a number of the medical criteria in the donor history questionnaire. And they looked for places like this where the change in risk would be nil to minimal. And they loosened up those criteria. They initially did it as a temporary intervention to help with the blood supply during that time period. This is one where they started to move in that direction, and then they continued it as a second step in 2022. I think these are the main points, that there's a medical reason behind each of the questions that we have, and all of our donor screening steps are in place to make it safe for the donor to make the donation and safe for a patient to receive that transfusion. We're always trying to work with medical information, what's in the literature and the science of the situation for each one of those question topics, and trying to move it forward. And the FDA has done it, and now we're implementing it.
And yet for James Bancroft, while he says it's fantastic that he can donate blood again.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming.
If you'd like more information, just go to our website, bloodworksnw.org, click on Donate, scroll down to What Do I Need to Know About Donating, and then click on Am I Eligible? And that just about does it for this edition of Bloodworks 101. I'm your host, John Yeager. See you next time.